When we think of the Nakba, we should always remember that it was made up of thousands of personal stories. 750,000 people were ethnically cleansed from their lands in Palestine. And actually, my father was a 12-year-old in 1948, and he was, along with his family, ethnically cleansed from Kanir, a small farming village there near Haifa. And they ended up in Jenin initially, under the protection of the Iraqi army, and then a couple of years later in Nur Shemes, a refugee camp near the city of Tulkarem.
The 15th of May will see many commemorate Nakba Day, marking the catastrophic establishment of the Zionist entity. The day of the 15th of May was chosen as it's the day after Israel celebrates its independence day. The Zionists at the time, they carried out an intense campaign of massacre, terror and looting, resulting in over 15,000 Palestinian deaths and leading to over 750,000 Palestinians being expelled from their land. The Nakba has stood as a grim marker of the Zionist criminality for 76 years, but the last 6 months have surpassed anything that came previously. Israel is now assaulting the last area of Gaza in Rafah, and the numbers injured and killed continue to grow. So with this backdrop in mind, we want to have a look at the Nakba today, as well as the latest on the current assault on Gaza. And I've got two guests with me today to discuss this. I've got Jamil Khan, who is a contributor to geopolitics.com. Assalamualaikum, Jamil.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's good to have you here. And my second guest is Umar Hussain. And Umar Hussain is actually from Palestine. Assalamualaikum, Umar.
Wa alaikum assalam, Adnan.
It's good to have you guys both. I think we'll jump straight into the discussion. Jamil, we'll begin with you. What was the context in Palestine prior to the Nakba? You know, many people are familiar with what took place in 1948, but can you give us an insight into, you know, what was going on in the region prior to the creation of Israel and the Nakba?
Okay, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you, Adnan. Let me go back a little bit and give a little bit of historical context, because that will kind of bring things to where this conversation is heading from your introduction. So if we look at Muslim presence in Palestine, we can go back to the time of Umar ibn al-Khattab, when the Muslims entered that land under Umar ibn al-Khattab in the year 637, where Umar himself, as the Khalifa of the Muslims, the ruler of the Muslims, he went to the city after having sent some of his army who were unable to penetrate the walls of the city. And then eventually the patriarch, Sophronius, 637, he handed the keys to the city to Umar ibn al-Khattab. And that's how this land came, if you like, under Muslim or Islamic rule. So generally under Islam, from that point, the Muslims, Jews and Christians, they lived peacefully. There were incidents in that history which were unfortunate, where there were examples of oppression against the other populations. But in most part, the Muslims, the Christians and the Jews, they lived very peacefully in this area. The only exceptions to that being obviously the advent of the Crusades, when the Eastern Christian Arabs were persecuted by the Crusaders because of their relationship and closeness to the Muslims. And if you look at Bernard Lewis, who is considered an eminent historian of Middle East from the previous century, I think he died in 2018, he concluded in his writing that the situation of Jews living under Islamic rulers was never as bad as in Christendom at its worst, even if it was never as good as in Christendom at its best. So he said there is nothing in Islamic history to parallel the Spanish expulsion and Inquisition and the Russian pogroms or the Nazi Holocaust. So he's comparing these two scenarios, saying, look, under Muslim rule, the area had a lot of stability between the different religions. And what's interesting is I met Rabbi Elhanan Beck of the Nitori Carter at an event 2023. And he's an Orthodox Jew who's against Zionism. Mentioned to me an interesting story. He said that he was born in Jerusalem, in Palestine, and he said that our neighbors were Muslim, and he said we had a very close relationship. And very often, he said, if my mother would leave to go run some errands, she would leave him and his siblings with a Muslim family. And conversely, if the Muslim family were out and they had to leave someone to look after their children, they would drop them off at their house. So the picture that, you know, he painted was that the relationship between the different religions, the different people, was very close, very peaceful before the advent of the British, who entered into this land after World War One. So World War One, you know, many of your listeners will know, was a war that was fought by the European powers against the Ottoman Caliphate, or the Ottoman state. It was a war in which the aim was to divide up the lands
and to take control. And this is a time when colonization, Western colonization, was at its pinnacle. And there's history there that your listeners can follow up on. And so when the British...
Let me just bring in Umar here. Jamil's obviously given quite a lengthy timeline there. What I wanted to get from you was, obviously 1948 was when the Nakba happened. What are some of the key events around the Nakba that you can tell us about that actually led to the catastrophe in the end?
I think that's a really important question. And actually, I think Jamil kind of alluded to the backdrop to that, which really was World War One and the occupation of Palestine by British forces. And it's actually very interesting that many people don't realize, but the first foothold into Palestine was actually through Gaza. So the British forces through Egypt attacked Gaza in March 1917 in the first Battle of Gaza, and were defeated. It was a very clear defeat against British forces then. And then a month later, in the second Battle of Gaza, they returned and again they were defeated. So what happened is the British realized that the Ottomans were putting up a very strong defense of Palestine. And to actually occupy Palestine, they would need to weaken the Arab world in particular. So you may have heard of the Hussein Makman correspondence, which took place between 1915 and 1916. And that was between the British High Commissioner for Egypt, Makman, and also the Sharif of Mecca, Hussein ibn Ali. And what they essentially promised him was that if he were to launch a revolt against the Ottomans, they would give him land. And that was kind of the prelude to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, where they actually shared out, the British and the French, the Middle East. So you had, for example, France taking Syria, Lebanon, and South Turkey, and the British took swathes of Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq. So you had this situation whereby the Ottomans were still a very, even though they were, you know, considered the sick man of Europe at that time, they were still able to put up an actual very, very good defense of Palestine and Gaza in particular. And they realized that they had to weaken the Ottoman state internally. So this Thawra al-Arabiya al-Kubra, as it's known, the Great Arab Revolt, essentially weakened the Ottoman state from within the Middle East. So you have this situation whereby they supported the Arab revolt. So in places like Jordan, they took the city of Aqaba, which is a very important strategic port city, in July 1917. And between May and October, they actually attacked the Hejaz railway that ran all the way from, as we know, Turkey into the Hejaz. And they sabotaged it, causing major issues in terms of the Ottomans being able to resupply their forces in Gaza. So what happened was they came back in November 1917 and actually took Gaza. What they were unable to achieve in the first two battles in March and April, they were able to achieve in November after weakening the Ottoman state. And they entered on the 1st of November. And would you believe it, on the 2nd of November, the Balfour Declaration was made. So they hadn't even gone out of Gaza. And that infamous Balfour Declaration was made on the 2nd of November 1917.
So Jamil, let me bring you back in here again. I've always had this question. There were obviously Arab Jews in the Middle East. However, the Zionist entity was established by Zionists from Europe. How did this fringe group from Europe end up with their own nation in the Middle East?
To understand a little bit of this, I mean, there was obviously the support of the Europeans. But if you look at the history, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. And that anti-Semitism, by the way, is a Western phenomenon. And there's an interesting book by Alan Harris Cutler, and I believe it's his wife Helen Cutler's, The Jew as an Ally of the Muslims, Medieval Roots of Anti-Semitism, where they argue that anti-Semitism has its roots in anti-Muslim hatred from the time of the Crusades. And so the Crusaders, they view the Jews the same way they view the Muslims, and the Jews also as some type of fifth column. And then throughout history, we know during the Spanish Inquisition, the pogroms in Russia, and so on and so forth. So the culmination of all of those events, they created an anti-Semitic Europe. And this is where towards the end of the 1800s, you had the rise of the Zionist movement. So now your specific question, how did the Zionist movement start from wanting a land for the Jewish people? How did that transform into where their population was less than 10% the time the British had occupied when they went into Palestine, what one was referring to over 27% by about 1935? So they used the events which were happening, the anti-Semitism that was widespread in Europe. And when the British, they entered into Palestine and they were given the mandate, and the mandate was essentially the spoils of war after World War One were divided up against the Allied forces. and Britain ended up with Palestine. Now, at that time in Britain, there was a lot of Zionists, and very specifically, there was a request from Lionel Walter Rothschild, a member of the British establishment, a Zionist leader and president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews from 1925 to 26. And he had written to Balfour requesting that this new land be considered as a homeland for the Jews, which Balfour accepted. And that's where we talked about the Balfour Declaration. Now, to understand how did we go from here to 1948 and the Nakba, is that the British at that time coming out of World War One, at that time, the crown, if you like, or the jewel in the crown of the British colony was India. And what Britain was concerned with at that time was the protection of the Suez Canal, because that was their trade route into India. And by, and although they had occupied Egypt in 1882, or they had significant influence, you found that Uller made a reference when the Ottomans, they in World War One attacked the British, they came through areas of the peninsula, okay, near Egypt, and that's how they ended up attacking the Suez Canal. And Britain knew that that they needed a greater buffer, right, in order to protect their trade routes. And it was that chain of events where to provide, because if you think about it, right, if you travel through the Suez Canal into India, you're looking at about 7,200 miles. If you go around the Horn of Africa, you're looking at about 1,200 miles. So that was a lot of time and a lot of costs for Britain, right, to go back to through its trade routes, right, to its jewel, being India. So Britain wanted to control this region. And this request from the Zionists for Britain to help them to make a land within Palestine was ideal. So for Britain, it would provide for them a partner, okay, to have access to trade routes. It would secure their geopolitical interests in the region, and it would align ideologically to Britain rather than the Muslim or the Arab world, which they had just worked to carving up after World War One. So it was the British support in order to achieve its goals and aims in the region. And it was the culmination of those events then later on, you know, with, and by the way, the Britain couldn't have done this without the, although the main focus is Britain, the other allied powers like the French, like the Germans, they supported this endeavor. And that's how you went from a population of less than 12% in 1917, 18 in Palestine to well over 27 to 35% by the time you go between 35 and 1940.
So Omar, two further questions for you regarding this. You know, for me, the numbers have never really added up. The vast majority of population in Palestine for a long period, even before the British occupation, were Muslim. So the odds were really against the British and the Zionists, but despite this, they were able to establish a foreign entity there. How is that possible? And, you know, what I wanted to know from you, what was life like for Palestinians under the British occupation? So this is from 1917 until 1948.
I think it's a very important question. And to understand this, we have to go back and look at what happened between 1917 and 1948 under the British mandate. So what occurred was the British actually supported the Zionist colonialists who were coming to this land to prepare for declaring the State of Israel. So during these years, they actually supported the Zionist gangs. For example, the Haganah, which is known as one of those Zionist gangs, the Irgun, the Lehi. Many of these forces were actually part of the British-run Palestinian police force. So many of them would actually go into the Haganah, and it would be something that was used to actually prepare them to essentially create a paramilitary police force. So you have the Notrim, which was actually set up by the British, and they were protecting, according to them, property of Jews and settlements, etc. But they were also being armed to be able to actually be that kind of first military force for the State of Israel. So over those decades, they were becoming much more powerful. So just to give you some personal stories, my grandfather and many people at that time were fully aware of what was happening. And that's why you have many revolts taking place. And the most infamous of them was the 1936 to 1939 Arab revolt in Palestine, which actually resulted in about 5,000 Palestinians being killed and tens of thousands more being wounded and imprisoned. My grandfather was one of those people who was imprisoned because many of them resisted. They fully knew what the plan was, which was to arm these gangs to be able to essentially be that first kind of military force for the State of Israel in the near future. So you had them resisting, and at the same time, the British were supporting them. and giving them a license essentially to be armed, to be trained, so that they would eventually be able to declare that state of Israel in 1948. Between 1922 and 1947, there was also a tenfold increase in the Jewish population in Palestine, while the Arab population only increased by double. So this was very much part of the policy of British at the time to massively increase the Jewish population in Palestine. And at the same time, as I said earlier, they were also allowing them to become more brazen in terms of their arms and their training. So they became essentially a paramilitary force, and their population had increased significantly. So they were building and buying out settlements and buying out land across Palestine. So just to give you an idea, my dad comes from a town or a village called Kanir, which is near Haifa, one of the main cities in Palestine. And near him, there was a town called Giviat Ada. And actually, that was named after one of the sponsors of Zionism, essentially. So the Rothschilds. So it was actually, I believe, one of the Rothschilds' wives. Her Jewish name or Hebrew name was Ada. So they essentially created these settlements, villages across Palestine, and were populating the land. Even though that was happening, you actually still had very good relations on a personal level between the Palestinians and the Jews. So they would regularly visit each other. There wasn't that kind of tension. The tension started more when they saw that these essentially paramilitary forces were being armed, and they could see that the ultimate aim was to essentially take Palestine as a land for the Jews. And that's where you started seeing that resistance.
So almost, I've always heard some of these terrorist groups, Zionist terrorist groups, they also carried out attacks against British forces. What was going on there? I've always heard, you know, although the British collaborated with a lot of these groups, there were some groups that were quite radical, and they actually launched attacks against the British forces as well. What was going on there?
Yeah, that's true, actually. There was a lot of resistance after the Arab revolt between 1936 and 39. They could see that the Palestinian population was not going to accept this plan to essentially take Palestine. These were their homes, these were their farmlands, and they could see the plan was being enacted. So there was a lot of resistance. And as I said, there was a huge number of deaths, and many people were imprisoned. So as a way to kind of appease the Palestinian population, and maybe to give cover to their more kind of their secretive plans with the Zionists, they did kind of try to limit migration, or there was some cap on migration. So this was seen as an attack against the Zionist plan. So yeah, so some of them took it in their hands to actually attack British forces. So there's obviously the famous incident where they attacked, I believe it was the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, and that killed many British soldiers and other people, innocent people who were in the hotel. So yes, they did not see eye to eye in some of the kind of specific strategy, but ultimately the British plan was always to kind of strengthen Jewish presence in Palestine through immigration and through the arming of paramilitary groups.
So the Nakba was in 1948. We're now in the 1950s. Israel is this very small nation, it's completely outnumbered by demographics and size by the Arabs in the region. How has it been able to survive after all these decades?
I mean, from the time it was established, it was obviously established with the recognition of Britain and the Europeans. The United Nations recognized it as a state as well. They extended a lot of support to it. For the first 20 years, by the way, it was actually the French who supported the state with providing it weapons, providing it political, logistical, and intelligence support. And then later on, after 67 war, the Americans entered into taking on that role and providing support for this entity. But at the same time, in parallel to this, the rulers in the Arab world, they were very complicit in ensuring that the state was not only just established, but it was also, if you like, solidified in that region. So between when it was established, if you remember the 1948 war, I mean, it's interesting because Jordan was a part of that war led by General Glubb, a British officer who's heading the Arab Legion across the Jordanian River into the West Bank, and then enters the land. Instead of taking all of the land back, they just stop. So that is only possible if the rulers of that country and the militaries by extension are in the hands of the foreign powers. So between the culmination of the Western nations and the United Nations, and if you remember, the United Nations was quite new at this, coming after the League of Nations. So the UN recognized the state. it provided it political support. The Western powers provided it political and military support. And then at the same time, the rulers in the Arab world who had been placed there, you know, if you go back and look at Sykes-Picot and how lands were divided, how the families in the Arab world were placed over these regions, they were there to support and to accept the existence of the Israeli state. And there was no real war that ever happened. So what happened in 1948 or 1956 or later in 67, when you go and investigate in detail, you'll find that although on the apparent there were wars taking place, in reality they were all tactical wars. And that was for the newly emerged Arabs who were placed in positions of ruling, for them to solidify their position by siding with the Western powers and fulfilling their ambitions vis-a-vis the state of Israel. There's an excellent book by Muhammad Haikal called Secret Channels. It's very much worth a read if you want to know how what was happening in public and what was happening behind closed doors, where there was meetings between the Zionist entity and the Arab rulers and the negotiations that were taking place. That will give you insight to really understand how that state was solidified and how it was able to not only just establish itself, but to reach the point where we are today.
So with regards to 1948 and also the wars that were to take place in subsequent years, I think we really have to understand the reality of the Middle East at the time. So you had Britain essentially playing both sides, or essentially pulling the strings on both sides. So just to quote a very interesting point by Professor John Knight in his paper in 2011, Securing Zion, Policing in British Palestine, he mentions the majority of these Jewish forces were supposedly for defensive purposes. Regardless, they were all members of the semi-secret underground Jewish army, the Haganah. The British were well aware of this and tacitly approved. In doing so, the British made a significant contribution to the Zionist project. So this is a very clear, essentially, understanding of what was going on, where the forces in Palestine were being built up, i.e. the Haganah and other military wings. And then, as Jamil mentioned, you have a situation whereby in Jordan, the British general actually overseeing the whole Jordanian army and the Arab armies who subsequently fought in 1948 was a British general, Sir John Bagot Glubb Pasha, as they call him in the Arab world, essentially the de facto head of the army. And actually what is mentioned in another very interesting article by Graham Jevon, he states that Glubb was essentially an integral tool in the maintenance of British control in the Middle East. So you have a situation here by 1948 where the supposed Arab armies were coming to the defense of Palestine from Jordan, from Egypt, from Iraq. These were maybe the three biggest contingents, but they were all essentially under Glubb. So you had one incident in 1948 which broke this mold. So there was a battle in Jenin, the Battle of Jenin, and that was led by an Iraqi general called Omar Ali Bayaktar. And he was someone who broke the chain of command, essentially, and fought a genuine battle in Jenin, and he decimated the Zionist forces there. It was a complete annihilation of the forces there. It was such a defeat that he actually wanted to take Haifa. So bear in mind, Jenin is now on the edge of the West Bank. Haifa is about, give or take, another 50-odd miles, maybe 40 miles from Jenin. So not a very significant distance. So he wanted to cross it. He wanted to make his move across Palestine and secure Haifa, which is one of the biggest cities in Palestine, which would have essentially split this newly formed state of Israel in half. What happened was that he was prevented from moving his forces. So he was given clear instructions that he would not be resupplied if he did so. So this was a complete setup. The intention was to avoid Palestine essentially being returned to its original owners and actually to consolidate the state of Israel. And Arab women used to sing a song. My dad tells me, my dad was there in 1948. He was a 12-year-old. So he lived under the Iraqi army in Jenin. And he tells me that they used to sing a song, the old women, and it would go like this. Shlunu ya Salih Zaki, Malku Amr. How is it, O Salih Zaki, that there's no order for the army to fight? Salih Zaki was the defense minister in Iraq. And they used to say, why are you not sending your troops? You know that you can rescue Palestine. So this was very much known at the time. So the Iraqi army was able to achieve a famous victory, which many people do not hear about. They don't talk about the Battle of Jenin. But that was one very decisive victory in 1948. And had General Omar Ali Bayraktar managed to move to Haifa, we would have seen a very different political and strategic situation there.
From the Palestinian side, we've seen a number of groups emerge over the decades, from the PLO to Hamas. How would you say they fared taking forward the Palestinian cause?
So, I mean, they're the two famous ones. There's a lot of other groups, as you know. Was created in 1964 as the coming together of different organizations. And then over the years, organizations such as Fatah and the Populating Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFPL, they were kind of integrated into this movement. The coming together of the organization and its stated goal was the ending of the occupation. And to this end, they engaged in, you know, guerrilla-style tactics, but were absorbed into surrounding armies, all of which who were under leaders that were in secret discussions with the occupier and limited their effectiveness, if you like. So to that extent, it weakened, you know, their cause because of those relationships. They moved to a more militant style, right, where they started to bombings, hijacking of planes. And one has to ask, what were they hoping to achieve, you know, by these activities? In most part, were happening outside of the occupied area. But if you look at the evolution of the PLO into the political engagement or into the normalization process, when that happened, and we're talking about now towards the end of the 80s, around close to the 90s, the resistance movement became a nationalistic one. So it narrowed the Palestinian file to a Palestinian Arab and then down to a Palestinian issue. It moved away from the idea of, although outside people still view Palestine from the lens of Islam and as Muslims, it tried to narrow that lens. Although it was seeking support from everywhere, it narrowed the lens to make it seem like an Arab to a Palestinian issue. So by absorbing the PLO into the political process and by their acknowledgement and recognition of Articles 242 and 338 of the United Nations, which in essence came into existence after 242, I think was after the Six-Day War in 67, and then 338 was in 73, which essentially acknowledges and accepts the occupation and the occupier and their right to be in that position. When the PLO accepted all of this and engaged in that political process, if you then map that back to its objective, because if you want to look at the success of an organization, you map it back to its objectives. It failed in the objective of liberation, and it failed in its objective of what later was, after the political process, to have a sovereign state. So I would argue that on both of these accounts, as an organization, in terms of the cause of Palestine, it's failed and it's narrowed that lens. And therefore, I don't believe the objectives it had set itself have been met, or I don't believe they would be met any time.
Omer, Hamas, what are the perceptions on the ground in Palestine regarding this group? I mean, pre-October 7th and post as well.
Yeah, I think that's it's an important question to understand what people in Palestine think about kind of resistance in general. And I think we must distinguish between the leadership of groups and the people and those resisting on the ground. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because what we've seen in the past, as Jamil has correctly stated, they have used many of these groups to actually achieve political objectives, one of the most important of which was to essentially narrow this discussion from an Islamic problem down to an Arab problem, now down to a Palestinian problem, which, you know, making it very much a nationalistic cause. And groups like Hamas, while they do have support because they're seen as essentially the face of resistance, I think what you find, there are a lot of people concerned about their ultimate objectives and also about the relationships that they may have with other nations. So, it, you know, believe that they have strong relations with Iran, Qatar, Turkey. We saw Ismail Haniyeh recently with Erdogan. We know that they have their base in Qatar. We know that they deal with the intelligence network in Egypt in terms of the negotiation for ceasefire, etc. So they're not working completely independently from the current status quo within the Middle East. So I think on a personal level, you'll find many of them sincerely believe in the need to resist this occupation, but they haven't necessarily mapped out a clear vision of where that would be, where would they want to take Palestine. You also have a very strange situation in Palestine where really it's split into two. You have Gaza on one hand, Gaza being ruled, as we know, by essentially a Hamas, a government. But then you have in the West Bank, they're ruled by obviously the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas, who's been very clear in his view that he needs to protect and defend the state of Israel. So many of the PA's forces have been used to make arrests, and they've actually killed several Palestinians who are resisting the occupation and the constant attacks within refugee camps and towns across the West Bank. So you have a very strange situation. I think the general feeling is anyone resisting is going to be seen in a positive light at the moment. I think just generally speaking, no one wants to speak out against those who are resisting occupation. However, I don't believe people are completely confident that there is a clear political plan that would liberate Palestine. And everyone, I think, doesn't feel that the two-state solution will bring about any kind of genuine freedom for the people in Palestine under occupation, be it in Gaza or the West Bank.
One of the issues with all of these movements is that they're not effective because they detach the Palestinian cause from Islam, and they decided to deal with it within the paradigm of nationalism and nation states. So the real issue of occupation of Palestine and how do you liberate and how do you overturn that occupation cannot be resolved within that paradigm, knowing all what we know of the history and the surrounding governments. And if any group is aligned to those governments, has a relationship with those governments, you cannot expect from what we know of history that any of these are going to assist any of these movements to achieve the goals which most of them set, as Omar said, you know, for resistance against occupation, but very quickly got absorbed. I mean, with Hamas and their relationship with Turkey, that got absorbed into directing Hamas towards what Turkey thought was a reasonable solution within the paradigm of nationalism, how they should view the Zionist entity. So I think if that framework doesn't change, any movement which works within that framework is going to have a problem. And just adding to the point about the view on the ground regarding these movements, also with recent events, obviously there's a global public opinion from the Western countries towards some of these movements. But it's important to know, just for your listeners, that although Hamas are considered a terrorist group by the UK and the US, that's a European-centric view. So the United Nations considers them as a legitimate government, right, from 2006. And many of the countries in the world, they don't actually label them a terrorist organization. They still consider them as a political movement or as a resistant movement. So the view of the lens of how they viewed in terms of as a terrorist organization is very much a European, UK, US centric view.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the two-state solution. For a long time now, the two-state solution is seen as the only viable solution to the problem in historic Palestine. Where did this come from? How has it become the only viable solution? And looking forward, is it actually even possible now?
It's interesting, when you look at the two-state solution, another kind of ridiculous plan that comes to mind was the UN partition plan that was presented by the UN in 1947, which essentially presented a plan to give, I think it was about 56% of the land to Jews who had migrated to Palestine, and the remainder, apart from a couple of percent, which was going to be an international zone within Jerusalem and Bethlehem. To the Palestinians, even though the Palestinians made up two-thirds of the population. So the Jewish population was going to take more than half the land, even though they only made up a third of the population. So you have in the two-state solution some of the very kind of similar, unfair and clearly unacceptable proposals. So, for example, in the West Bank, you have settlements dotted around the West Bank, and they actually break up the ability for people to travel from an area. So you have in like near Nablus, which is a very big city in the West Bank, settlements that sit on the mountains overseeing some of these large cities. So there's one settlement, I think it's called Ariel, and it actually has a university there. We're not talking about small settlements of a few hundred people. These settlements have not been, there's been no clear solution about how they will be dealt with. You've got the situation of Jerusalem and how it will be mentioned, Al-Quds. You've got the question about the return of refugees, the right to return for refugees, many of those displaced from 1948 Palestine. So there's many issues. But what we really see is the people pushing the two-state solution are essentially only the Palestinian Authority. There is no one in Palestine, probably a tiny percentage, who support the two-state solution, be that in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. They both see it as something that is completely unworkable. And it would essentially mean completely giving up their right to the land of Palestine, except for a few pieces of land here and there, which would still be dictated under Israeli policy when it comes to, you know, in terms of security, in terms of the supply of energy, supplies, etc. They control all the borders. They control the airport. If you remember, there was an airport in Gaza, which they bombed. And if you try to cross from Palestine, whether you go from Jordan or from Egypt, as we know, Israel dictates who comes in, who goes out. And if anyone's ever traveled there, you have to go through Israeli checkpoints and intelligence. So it's very much something that's being sold as a plan that was cooked up many decades ago, essentially something the US backed. But as time has gone on, I think people see it as completely unviable and not something that anyone supports really on the ground.
If I can just add, right, so in December 22, there was you know, a Pew poll, I think it was, support for a two-state solution was 33% amongst Palestinians, 34% amongst Israeli Jews, and 60% amongst Israeli Arabs. But out of those numbers, 82% of Israeli Jews and 75% of Palestinians believe that the other side would never accept, right, the existence of their independent state, which is interesting. And then by October 2023, in I think it was a Gallup poll, the idea of a two-state solution had 71.9% of Israeli Arabs supporting it, 28.6% of Israeli Jews. In that same month, 24% of Palestinians supported two-state solution. So as, you know, which was a huge drop, right, 59% from 2012. So as Ahmad said, the Muslim street rejects it. The Palestinian normal people reject it. Even the right-wing Likud and the Zionist Jews, they reject it. The only people that accept are a few of the Arab rulers, and they're only because they don't have an independent mouth. Their mouth is the American mouth. So they're only representing what America is seeking in the region. The populations, like I said, on the ground don't accept it, and there may be some secular Zionists inside Israel who accept it because they view, you know, the state as being non-religious. So it's a very, you know, small set of people, but it has... its future is basically doomed. After what has happened now, how are you going to move to that situation? Even some people are talking about a one-state solution, a secular Israeli state where everybody lives. But even in that, if you look at some of the polling that's been done, okay, the view amongst Zionists is that if Palestinians are absorbed into a single state, which, by the way, the main Zionist groups don't accept because that takes away what they've been hanging in terms of the Jewish identity. But at the same time, what rights should Palestinians or Arabs have under that single state? Okay, there is no agreement. It ranges from a very 10%, I think, if I'm not mistaken, of Zionist Jews who believed that everyone should have equal rights to a vast overwhelming percentage which believe that anything absorbed into a single state, that the Arabs should not enjoy the same rights as others. So none of these are a viable practical solution when it comes to the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so coming to the current events taking place, where would you say things currently stand?
All right, so 7 months on, where do things stand? You mentioned right in your introduction about the varying, you know, we talked about the different powers which have been involved in this region. And to this end, that reality remains the same. So let me start to try to dissect this, because this is not an easy situation to understand. So America's position since the events of 7/10 have been to, they accepted that Israel was going to respond. What I don't believe that they foresaw was the nature of the response, right, which is by all intents and purpose and definition a genocide. So I don't believe America foresaw that. And since the escalation from the Zionist inside of Gaza, you find that America has been working in, although on the face of it, America seems like it's supporting what is happening. And that's because it needs to maintain Israel as its closest ally in the region. So it can't weaken that by making public statements, which may embolden other nations in that region. It wants to also contain the escalation. It was very concerned that the response from the Zionist entity may lead to an escalation of the conflict to the wider region. So it has to show that it still supports that entity. But in reality, if we look at it in the background, America sent, you know, high-level officials from the CIA and the current administration, including Blinken, the Secretary of State, to sit in on the Israeli War Cabinet meetings to influence the direction and ensure that events do not escalate. America has threatened recently, if you remember, they were looking at reviewing, right, the weapons that are being supplied to the entity. And they said that would be under review, especially now after plans which have been proposed by Netanyahu for Rafah, and where publicly Biden and a number of, you know, broadsheets published these articles where publicly Biden has said that America will will review. He didn't say it will cut the supply of weapons, but he said it will review what it's providing, because they felt, it seems like they've been blind for the last 7 months, but they felt that some of these may be used to, the weapons that they provided may have been used to kill civilians, as if though you needed any war justification than what is already apparent and clear. So America has tried to put out, you know, coded warnings into the Zionist entity. He has used his allies in the region, especially Egypt and Jordan, to say that they will not accept Palestinian refugees. So if the Israelis went into Gaza, they went into Rafah, and they attempted to take over Gaza and push out the Palestinian population, that this is not an option. And even in I think it was in March, they met Benny Gantz, who's a minister without a portfolio, against the advice of Netanyahu. So all of these are attempts to pressure Netanyahu, right, to end what is currently happening, and then to renegotiate in a peace settlement, and then think about a future for Palestine. So this is from the American camp. From the Israeli camp, before Netanyahu came back into power in 2022, in 2019, he was facing charges internally, and he could have ended up in prison. So when he came to power in 2022, he sided with the right wing against the advice of the Americans, who asked him not to do that, but he continued. And some of the parties who are currently aligned to him, these ultra-right wing parties, you know, they're talking about expulsion of Arabs, the increasing of what is being termed as illegal settlements, relaxing laws that enable the security agencies to fire upon, you know, Arabs. They have violated the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Masjid and all of these kind of things, and even the annexation of the West Bank. So this is who Netanyahu is aligned to. So on the one hand, he has America, who's saying you need to pull back. On the other hand, he has these right wing, which are telling him, no, we need to take over everything. So the question is what are the options going forward, was what was your question. From my perspective and reading, option one is that Netanyahu falls in line with the Americans, ends the attacks, negotiates a peace deal, and then you'll have to negotiate the return of the Palestinians back into Gaza from where they are today taking refuge. And then how do you rebuild Gaza? And then there's also been discussion of an international force to oversee the security. That is unlikely to happen from the Zionist side. I don't see them accepting that. From their side, I think their preference is expulsion of Palestinians into the Sinai and to build either some type of tent city or for the Egyptians to take money from outside, whether from the Gulf or whether from the Americans or the Europeans, to develop the area in the Sinai and make that a place for the Palestinians who were previously in Gaza. And Gaza is overtaken by the Israelis or under some type of international oversight, and then later complete Israeli control. But definitely with the Americans, they want an end to escalations. They want a two-state solution. That's what they've been working towards. But America is also an election year, so it's under a lot of pressure. And the Israelis, for all intents and purposes up to today, they're not really interested in what the American position is. And they've said that, take away our weapons, we will still fight. We've got enough to enact our strategy for Rafah. And, you know, they can afford to do that because they know that they are, you know, the American ally in the region. They know that America's, how far can it really go? America's also at its weakest at the time of election. So there is considerations at home that can they turn against the Zionist votes, the Zionist money that these political parties are always reliant upon. So I think all of these variables are at play. And it'll be interesting to see where things move forward.
Just going to add one additional point. You have a situation as well in the region where the current leaders have really been exposed in terms of their inaction. In fact, even worse than that, they've even contributed to supplying the Zionist entity despite their genocide on Gaza over the last 7 months. So you've seen Blinken make numerous visits to the region, visiting heads of state. He's been to Jordan, Egypt, and you have a very strong view on the Arab street against the position of the Arab regimes. And I think that's something else that the US has to take into consideration. So de-escalation for them and finding a solution is key, because ultimately the feeling on the ground is that there should be much more support for the Palestinian cause. And what people would wish is actually military intervention, but that's something that's not even on the cards with the current leaders in place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, final question for you both. The protests we're seeing on university and college campuses in America,
What does this tell us? What can we make of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting. There's a different analysis about how these may have kicked off across the US. I think in terms of what they do show is a very strong sentiment against the Israeli occupation. And I think you've seen, obviously, that spread from the US across the world. And I think that's been a change or challenging the narrative that's been put out in the Western media over a number of decades. And we can see that social media has played a huge role in that. We know TikTok was specifically highlighted as a platform that helped shape the views of many youth in America, and many of those would be people in universities. And they see the injustice, they see the complete contradiction and double standards when it comes to international law. They saw the double standards when it came to Ukraine and Russia. They see the mass murder of civilians, which are screened to our mobile phones every day. And I think that has really created an awakening. And as we know, with youth and people in university, they're yet to be committed in terms of bills and life and mortgages and jobs. And so they usually are the first to kind of rise up against what they see as an injustice. We saw that in Vietnam, and they played a huge role in kind of changing public opinion in the US and eventually bringing an end to the Vietnam War. So I think the youth and university students in general will always have a stronger feeling for justice and won't have many of those things that silence them because of fear of, you know, losing jobs or money or bills and things like that. And I think they've had a really huge impact actually in the Muslim world, particularly in the Arab world where I was in Jordan. The US kind of university demonstrations were being discussed in almost every gathering that I attended. So people saw that as a real shift in Western public opinion when it comes to the issue of Palestine and, you know, the Israeli occupation there.
I think the only thing I think I'll add to that is that I think these demonstrations show people's, you know, humanity. And now that they're aware of what is happening, because, you know, mainstream media for many years has controlled that narrative. And now with the advent of social media, as Umar said, there are people got an alternative view and they're seeing live pictures and they can map that back to mainstream media and see the hypocrisy and the contradictions. People can also see in the very lands in the Western countries where these are meant to be beacons of liberal values about freedom of expression, human rights, you find that their police force and their politicians are behaving in ways and instructing those forces to behave in ways which previously they would have attributed to dictatorships. And you find the response in the campuses in America has been extremely harsh towards those students, which is an opportunity for people to, you know, have this conversation that what does freedom of expression or human rights, what do all of these things really mean? And who defines their parameters for other human beings, right? Are they really universal? Are they really there for everybody? Or are they just for one set of people to fulfill their worldview towards events? So I think, you know, those are interesting conversations that do come up now and then. But definitely, I think there is, you know, we can see positive things in the way that people have reacted and really how human beings, you know, this humanitarian value that people have inside of them that makes them understand what oppression is and how it should be. People should stand up against it.
Jamil Umar, thank you for your time and your insights today.
Thank you very much, Izakal.
If you want to learn more about the issues raised today, then please check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dive. I'm Adnan. Thank you for listening.